Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Celebrations mark first German registrations of same-gender couples, British Columbia High Court wraps up marriage rights hearing, and a Baldwin-based analysis of Bush's faith-based initiative. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 4th, 2001. Gay and lesbian couples in Germany contracted legal registered life partnerships for the first time this week. Berlin lesbians Angelica Baldo and Gudrun Panier were generally reported as the first couple to register, although Hanover gay male couple Heinz Haar and Reinhard Lüschau may have actually preceded them. Baldo and Panier wore matching tailcoats and bow ties for the occasion and cut a three-tiered cake with two bride figures and a rainbow flag. Baldo adopted Panier's surname. Dozens of other couples across Germany exchanged rings, kisses, and champagne toasts, including 15 couples who registered simultaneously in Hamburg. Hamburg City Hall was decorated in rainbow colors for the occasion, and in Hanover, the mayor was present to congratulate new couples. Berlin's new openly gay mayor, Klaus Wowereit, wrote an open letter to new couples, saying, "You have taken the first step into new territory." He added that the new law doesn't fulfill everyone's wishes and dreams, but it's a great step forward. 300 couples are expected to have registered by the end of August. The partnerships carry some significant marital rights, but are threatened by a constitutional court challenge to be heard in October. One of the plaintiffs in that lawsuit, the state of Bavaria, was one of three states that failed to prepare to register gay and lesbian partnerships as the new law went into effect August 1st, sparking a protest demonstration in Munich.
Legal recognition of gay and lesbian couples is part of a sweeping law reform package against discrimination to be introduced later this year by the government of the state of West Australia. This week, State Attorney General Jim McGuinty presented the state parliament with a 200-page review of the legal status of gays and lesbians, including recommendations for nearly 50 reforms. Gay and lesbian activists participated in the development of the report by a government-appointed advisory committee. As McGuinty said, Western Australia is light years behind the rest of Australia in tackling the issue of discrimination against gays and lesbians. He called the state code the most restrictive and discriminatory laws in Australia. The top recommendation is the addition of sexual orientation as a category protected under the state's Equal Opportunity Act from discrimination in areas including employment and accommodations. Perhaps the most controversial recommendation is equalization of the age of consent, which is currently 21 for homosexual acts and only 16 for heterosexual ones. Recognition of same-gender couples is recommended in areas including medical decision-making, parental rights, fertility treatment, pensions, inheritance, and property. Once the reform legislation is introduced, the opposition Liberal Party will allow its members to vote their consciences, while the ruling Labour Party will vote as a bloc. Since the Green Party also supports reform, passage appears likely.
Hopes for passage of a U.S. bill to prohibit sexual orientation discrimination in employment are at a new high. The Employment Non-Discrimination Act, ENDA, was reintroduced this week. Some form of U.S. federal gay and lesbian civil rights bill has been repeatedly introduced since 1974, but only once has there ever been a floor vote, when ENDA failed by a single vote in the Senate in 1996. The Senate's Democratic leadership will schedule another Senate floor vote this year, and ENDA is expected to pass there. But a floor vote in the Republican-controlled House remains doubtful, even though it's believed the bill has majority support there. Senate co-chief sponsor Ted Kennedy promised that if ENDA is kept off the House floor, he'll attach its language to another bill to force its consideration in a House-Senate conference committee. ENDA would bar sexual orientation discrimination in hiring, firing, promotions, and compensation by government and private sector employers and by labor unions. It specifically exempts the military, religious groups and religious schools, and businesses with less than 15 employees. It contains no provision for domestic partner benefits and specifically states that it does not create affirmative action requirements for gays and lesbians.
Hungarian gays and lesbians celebrated an historic legal victory this week over a Budapest district mayor who tried to bar their exhibits from the huge Pepsi Island Youth Music Festival. Judge Judith Vita granted the Hator Support Society for Gays and Lesbians a preliminary injunction blocking the discriminatory clause District Mayor István Tarlós had forced into a contract with festival organizers. She cited the Hungarian Constitution's prohibition against discrimination, even though it does not explicitly include sexual orientation among protected categories. She wrote that the mayor, as a state agent, had no right to sign an agreement that, far from reducing inequalities, strengthens society's prejudices against sexual minorities. Gabor Krushing of the gay and lesbian civil rights group Habeas Corpus said the injunction marks the first time that the collective rights of sexual minorities have been protected by the state. The last time gay issues went to court, in 1995, to allow youth under the age of 18 permission to join a gay rights group, the court ruled against them. The injunction is also unique because for the first time, it directly interprets the Hungarian Constitution as defending the rights of sexual minorities. Mayor Tarlós is appealing the ruling, and Hungary's Justice Minister Ibolya David denied that Tarlós had abused his authority. Meanwhile, the Pepsi Island Festival opened this week, including its Magic Mirror marquee, where gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and feminist groups are presenting a full week of speakers, films, and performances. Magic Mirror is sponsored by the European Union's ambassador in Hungary, Michael Lake, who spoke at its kickoff.
The European Union's Enlargement Commissioner has confirmed that nations hoping to join the EU will have to act against sexual orientation discrimination. Commissioner Gunther Verheugen wrote in a letter last week to ILGA, the International Lesbian and Gay Association, that equal treatment of gays and lesbians is a basic principle of the EU and one that will be given its full attention in consideration of new member states. Verheugen's statement is believed to apply particularly to former Eastern Bloc nations. The European Parliament has already affirmed that it will not consent to the accession of any country that violates gay and lesbian human rights.
But ILGA itself this week was denied observer status in an upcoming anti-racism conference by the United Nations. The landmark World Conference Against Racism will be held in South Africa in September, and UN representatives were preparing for it in a special drafting session in Geneva. In the absence of a Swedish representative and with 27 nations abstaining, a vote on ILGA's status ended in a 43-43 tie as EU nations faced off with members of the Organization of the Islamic Conference. A majority was necessary for Brussels-based ILGA to be recognized. Previously, the Organization of the Islamic Conference had attempted to bar a speaker from the San Francisco-based International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, IGLHRC, from speaking at the UN's special session on HIV/AIDS, but was ultimately foiled. Many ILGA members will be attending the anti-racism meeting, and a demonstration will be held there to protest the group's official exclusion.
In Britain, a lesbian teacher who was harassed by students lost a second round in her discrimination lawsuit. Shirley Pierce experienced years of abuse and charged that the Mayfield School in Portsmouth had failed to protect her. But this week, the Court of Appeal upheld the finding of an industrial tribunal that Britain's Sex Discrimination Act applies only to issues of gender, not of sexual orientation. Pierce may appeal to the House of Lords. If her abuse were occurring today, it would likely represent a violation of Britain's new Human Rights Act.
In Malaysia, police made 35 arrests in a raid on a gay club near Segambut. Police said they were acting on neighbors' complaints. Six of those arrested were club employees who were charged with entertainment regulation violations. The rest were club patrons who were charged for committing illegal sex acts on the premises. They were released from custody after giving statements. Malaysia's former Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim is currently appealing a sodomy conviction that's widely believed to have been part of a conspiracy to eliminate him as a political threat to Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad.
The South Korean government shut down a leading gay website this week. IvanCity.com had been visited about 10,000 times each day. It was quashed by the Government-Affiliated Information and Communication Ethics Committee, ICEC, enforcing a so-called grading system that went into effect July 1st. That grading system lists homosexuality among criteria used to deem a site harmful, and the ICEC has described homosexuality as decadent and unhealthy. In addition to censoring Korean-based websites, the ICEC intends to require filtering of foreign-based sites catering to gays and lesbians. In response, 19 gay and lesbian advocacy groups formed a coalition to denounce what they called an evident infringement of the human rights of homosexuals and other sexual minorities. Their press conference featured Seoul Queer Film Festival organizer Cho Dong-jin and Korea's first openly gay celebrity, comic actor Hong Seok-chung.
And finally, chalk up another honor for openly gay award-winning British TV host Graham Norton. A statue of him will be displayed at London's legendary Madame Tussauds Waxworks. He sat for the sculptor this week, and the figure will be displayed in about 6 months. But immortality brings unexpected problems. The style-conscious Irish-born comic said, "I'm having great trouble deciding what my figure will wear, because it's got to be right for the day and into the evening and following the seasons. It's quite a demanding outfit."
That's NewsWrap for the week ending August 4th, 2001, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
Canadian activists reflect on the 9 days of hearings on their marriage rights lawsuit before British Columbia's Supreme Court later in the program. Ever since U.S. President George W. Bush's administration unveiled its so-called faith-based initiative for funding religious social service organizations, lesbian, gay, bi, and trans activists have been concerned about its possible impact on civil rights. Although the proposal has already passed the House of Representatives, that body's first open lesbian, Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, believes there's still hope. Baldwin discusses the significance of the initiative and her prognosis in a conversation with Danielle Corcoran of Query on WORT-FM in Madison.
The president has forwarded legislation that sends federal taxpayer dollars directly to religious institutions in order for them to participate in providing social services programs of a certain variety. And this is similar to activities that have happened in the past, but the real difference about this initiative is that the federal taxpayer dollars go directly to the religious institution rather than separate charitable arms of the religious institution. This is very problematic in terms of our First Amendment and separation of church and state.
Is there also language within the bill itself that exempts religious organizations receiving federal funds from abiding by state and local non-discrimination laws?
What happens right now is that all churches, all religious institutions already enjoy an exemption from anti-discrimination laws in our country because of the First Amendment, because government can't regulate places of worship. So this bill doesn't add anything new. What it does is provide tax dollars directly to churches. They argue that they're supposed to use those tax dollars to provide a social service. But because we're providing the tax dollars directly to the religious institutions, they can maintain their right to discriminate on the basis of religion, to ignore local and state ordinances that also protect a wide range of people from employment discrimination. And this is of enormous concern because it opens up, I think, the first time that I can ever recall where federal taxpayer dollars could be used directly to discriminate against Americans on the basis of religion and other bases.
So what are the implications of this legislation then for queer Americans?
Certainly, it's a threat on many levels. Because this legislation appears to supersede all state and local anti-discrimination laws, and in addition, even to the extent that religious institutions are allowed to prefer people from their own religion, this would be a concern to LGBT Americans because certain religious faiths and traditions do not accept homosexuality. And therefore, by extension of logic, there would be additional ways in which religious institutions could discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. The good news is that this bill has not become law. It has only passed one of the two houses of Congress, and we have to do everything we can to make sure that the Senate slows this down and insists upon both a true separation of church and state as well as non-discrimination language.
What kind of support do you think there is for changes like that in the Senate?
I'm encouraged that both the leadership of the Senate has stated fairly loudly and fairly clearly that they intend to slow this down and take a good look at it, but also some of the members of the U.S. Senate who have in concept supported faith-based initiatives are saying that this is not the version of the bill that they could support, and they're willing to agree to vote against it if they can't get appropriate amendments, and obviously they'll be fighting to get the non-discrimination language in it that we need.
Massachusetts Democratic Representative Barney Frank said that the Republican Party has launched a new anti-gay offensive with the support of the White House. Would you say that you agree with that? And what is the climate like right now in terms of opportunities to introduce queer-friendly legislation in Congress?
Well, I absolutely agree with Barney Frank on his assessment of this initiative. I think what's happening is that rather than introducing legislation that discriminates very overtly, what they're doing is the same thing that they've done with a woman's right to choose. They're trying to whittle away at the achievements that the LGBT community has already made in localities, in collective bargaining agreements, in statewide legislation. They're trying to whittle that away. And I think that if the LGBT community does not recognize this as an assault that requires an all-out response, we're going to get blindsided, essentially, by their strategies.
As lesbian U.S. Congressmember Tammy Baldwin told reporter Danielle Corcoran, support for amending Bush's faith-based initiative is increasing in the Senate. Last week, Republican Senator Rick Santorum announced his opposition to the anti-discrimination exemption for religious social service groups, and former Democratic vice presidential candidate Senator Joe Lieberman said he was working on an alternate version of the bill. Meanwhile, there's another twist on the faith-based controversy. The Reverend Troy Perry of the Universal Fellowship of Metropolitan Community Churches says that if the proposal passes, his predominantly gay and lesbian denomination will seek its share of federal funds for community services and join with other organizations to monitor the implementation of the law.
I gotta have faith. I gotta have faith. Because you gotta have faith.
Hello, this is Bruce Valanche, you know, the big blonde Muppet on the Hollywood Squares, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine.
Canada's first court hearing on the same-gender marriage issue wrapped up on August 2nd after a 9-day hearing in the Supreme Court of British Columbia. The case involves Canada's national queer rights lobby group, EGAL, Equality for Gays and Lesbians Everywhere, whose legal team represents 5 couples in the case. Another group of 3 plaintiff same-gender couples call themselves the BC Partners. All are seeking the right to be legally married under Canadian law. Currently in Canada, same-gender couples and unmarried heterosexual couples have virtually the same rights and responsibilities as married couples under federal law. Same-gender couples are also equal to straight couples under British Columbia provincial law. But the parties in the court case believe that society won't see their relationships as truly equal until they are able to participate in the institution of marriage. Heather Kitching of Queer FM on CITR in Vancouver has more from the second week of the hearing.
Chapel and we're gonna get married. Gee, I really love you and we're gonna get married. Going to the chapel of love.
There was plenty of comic relief at the home of Jane Hamilton and Joy Masahara on Thursday after the Supreme Court of British Columbia wrapped up a 9-day hearing on the issue of same-gender marriage. 8 couples are challenging a federal common law, which the government claims defines marriage solely as a heterosexual union. Last Wednesday, lawyer Cynthia Peterson began her arguments on behalf of 5 of the couples, as well as Canada's national queer rights lobby group AGAL, by urging the court to simply declare that Canada has no law against same-sex marriage. It is true that Canada has no written law barring such marriages, and the current refusal to recognize them is based on a 19th-century British court ruling on the issue of polygamy, which stated that a Christian marriage was a marriage between one man and one woman for life to the exclusion of all others. Peterson says, among other things, that courts have been wrong to consider the judge's ruling on the issue of polygamy to be authoritative on the issue of same-sex marriage. Peterson went on to argue that if the judge did believe there was a common law against same-sex marriage, he nonetheless had the power to change it and should. In part, she argued, the law should be changed because it violates Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which bans discrimination based on sexual orientation. Peterson's arguments were followed up by those of lawyers Barbara Findlay and Kathleen Leahy, who represent the other 3 couples in the case. They added that the law barring same-sex marriage also offends other sections of the Canadian Constitution, including those which bar sex discrimination and guarantee freedoms of life, liberty, and security of the person and mobility rights. This week in court, the lawyer for the Canadian government made her case against same-sex marriage, followed by 2 religious interveners, the BC Coalition for Marriage and the Family and the Interfaith Coalition for Marriage. Speaking for the Attorney General for Canada, lawyer Judith Bowers argued that the institution of marriage as a union of a man and a woman is unique in society and therefore should withstand constitutional challenge.
We say that when you're looking at societal building blocks, for a long time the idea of marriage and the family in the traditional sense has been the basis of society. The way we defend it is simply by leading the types of evidence that we did in this case, and that is evidence from historians, from sociologists, from anthropologists, from linguists, from legal scholars, giving their analyses and their opinions with regard to what the institution of marriage means and or how it is a fundamental aspect of our civilization and society.
But assuming that all of these things are true, how can you nonetheless say that it's not an institution that can be extended to same-sex couples when you consider that the interpretation of laws and of the Charter of Rights has to expand and grow over time with changing attitudes in society?
Well, of course, everything changes and attitudes change. But as far as your question, I'm going to duck it because I think that's the issue before this court.
The Attorney General
John
of
Fisher
was,
of Canada's National Queer Rights Lobby Group, AGAL, comments on the performance of the Attorney General's lawyer in court.
She was asked several times what would be the negative consequences of letting us marry, and her response to that was, well, no negative consequences have been identified, but there's the potential for negative consequences. And the judge responded and said, well, you know, what are they? And she said, well, that's for the court to decide, which is, you know, a clever answer, but not ultimately persuasive, I didn't think.
Cindy Silver is one of the lawyers for the BC Coalition for Marriage and the Family. The coalition was in court advocating that same-sex couples be given all the same rights and responsibilities of marriage under a different regime, such as a domestic partnership, without actually being included in the definition of marriage itself. While the couples in the case argue that such a regime would be like the so-called separate but equal regime struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court regarding racially segregated schools, Silver says such a regime would be justified in this case.
What the petitioners have asked for is not just benefits and rights, but a social status that the court require people to accept them as morally and socially equal. And for some people that is adverse to their rights to belief, or even if it's not based on faith, but to conscience beliefs. And that's where you come up with the collision of liberties in the case. They argue, for example...
Lawyer Cynthia Peterson explained some of Agel's responses to the BC Coalition, which were presented in court following their submissions.
We have a number of responses to their arguments. I mean, we say, for example, that there's no infringement on the freedom of religion. Agel or none of the petitioners in this case are demanding that the Catholic Church or that an Orthodox synagogue or a mosque or any religious body that opposes same-sex marriage, we're not demanding that they solemnize same-sex marriages. We're just saying we want the right to have the law recognize same-sex marriages, and we'll go to places that welcome us to get married, or maybe we'll just go down to Civil Hall if we want to get married. City Hall, pardon me. So we don't see an infringement on freedom of religion there.
The court hearing wrapped up Thursday afternoon and was followed by a party at the home of one of the couples in the case, where a number of people shared their thoughts on how the hearing went. The first is David Short, one half of one of the couples in the case. The second is John Fisher, the executive director of Canada's national gay rights lobby group, AGAL.
It was kind of an emotional roller coaster, really. There were moments where it was dry legal argument from my, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so some of the time I didn't know what they were talking about. And then there were moments that really touched me, and today was one of those days. When Barbara finished her argument, she talked about how this is about all gay people, not just about the people involved in the case. And it really touched me personally. I felt like my voice had been heard. So there were some powerful moments.
What did you think, John?
The arguments that have been raised by the government, by the interveners, are the same old arguments we've heard for years. For me, one of the memorable moments of the hearing was when she described heterosexual procreation as the historical purpose of marriage rather than the historical purpose. And, of course, we were rolled with laughter, and the judge acknowledged that many people would probably agree with her that this was a historical purpose. There was something about the institution of marriage which still strikes at the hearts and minds of some heterosexuals as something which is just a big social institution that can't be changed. I really think the law is easy. This is not a hard case. Heterosexuals can get married, gays and lesbians can't. Is this discrimination? Well, yes, of course it is. Is there a government justification for it? Well, none was identified. And these cases aren't won and lost on legal principles, unfortunately. They're won and lost on how comfortable a judge is with changing what is perceived to be a fundamental social institution. He is still a judge who, I think, places a lot of value on intellectual rigor and on the integrity of the analysis. And we have very good written submissions and authorities that when he sits down and reads through, I think there is a good chance he'll realize there is no merit in the opposition point of view. So we are still somewhat hopeful that he will find enough favor, and that remains to be seen.
The judge in the case has stated that he hopes to have a decision within 90 days. Whatever he decides, the ruling will certainly be appealed all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada, a process which will take at least 5 years. Meanwhile, lawyer Cynthia Peterson is back home in Ontario preparing for a November hearing on same-sex marriage cases filed in that province. For This Way Out, I'm Heather Kitching in Vancouver.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Graham Underhill, Chris Ambidge, Jason Lynn, Brian Nunes, Rex Walkner, Danielle Corcoran, and Heather Kitching contributed program material. Thanks also to Amber Ault and Joanne Powers. George Michael performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can also hear This Way Out anytime online exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on multimedia, then on radio. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through designated contributions by Uncommon Cloud Visa card holders who've chosen This Way Out and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. For an urgent message about This Way Out's critical financial situation, please visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening on KAZU Pacific Grove, California, WHUS Storrs, Connecticut, for ZZZ Brisbane, Queensland, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.